Welcome to Level Up Legacy. My name is Matt Chaff.
And I'm Michael White.
So this week, fundamentals of magic and how to improve.
Through the lens of legacy.
Yeah, which is important because I feel like it's the format where we can grow the most.
Well, I mean, it's the format we like to play the most, so we might as well grow while we're doing it.
Okay, so what are the sort of core skills? How do you address these?
I come from a background of playing a lot of competitive fighting games, and within that you can break down kind of three categories of improvement. There's the body, which is technique. This is what a lot of people spend time on, is making your combos really good and being able to play the game physically. You have the heart, which is kind of a fancy way of saying the playing of your opponent. Like being able to manipulate them, understanding what they're going to do and how to react to that. And then you have the mind, which is deeply understanding the engine of the game and how best to exploit that. Magic, being a physical card game, does not have any real techniques. You can't practice drawing a card off the top of your deck and then placing it and tapping it just so. That doesn't help you at all.
I mean, it does to a certain extent, but a very minimal extent.
Yeah, I mean, no one ever goes, oh, did you see the way Owen Turtenwald tapped his mountain? We have to kind of take a step back and try and figure out what are the core skills, the fundamentals of being a good Magic player. Matt, what do you think some of those are?
I think that you can sort of break it down into a couple of areas. We've got, you need to be able to do your basic math.
Yep.
Basic arithmetic, super, super important. You need to have a lot of knowledge of the game. That's like card pool, rules, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
You need to have control over your own emotional state, your own mental state.
Mm-hmm.
Really, really important. And you need to be able to read your opponent.
Yep.
I think there's another one that I'm forgetting right now.
Yeah, I like to think the biggest one is the evaluation of any given game state.
How did I forget that one?
Yeah. So, I mean, that's the most esoteric, kind of intangible, but it's at the same time, that's what Magic is about. It's this, there could be X, Y, and Z, there's all these variants and variables, and games are rarely won or lost on the back of, you should have clearly done this one thing.
Yeah, we talked about this a lot before, where there is no correct line, there are just least wrong lines,
mm-hmm.
or like degrees of less wrong.
But we'll just back it up and start with something, a more basic topic to approach, which is math skills.
Oh yeah, math is so important. It's so incredibly important, from figuring out your probability to doing combat math. All of these things are, Magic just so math-based. And so being able to do just, like, basic addition, subtraction, and, like, multiplication, division is really important
yep.
when it comes down to it. Some examples of this are, like, when you're doing combat math, you want to know how much damage you can deal your opponent through their blockers, if they block in certain ways, whether or not creatures will trade easily. Like, every time you resolve combat between two creatures,
mm-hmm.
you're doing basic math.
Yep.
And doing that with speed will take minutes off of your clock so that you can finish your matches more quickly. Things like Storm and Dredge are more complicated, where you need to do a bunch of different calculations quickly.
Yeah, you can't really play those decks unless you're able to do these basic functions really quickly. Like in Storm, it's very, you know, you're counting the amount of mana you have versus the number of Storm, and do those numbers add up to a way that you can kill your opponent. Dredge, you have to be able to do very quick multiplication for, or addition of dredging your library out if you're trying to combo off. Say, like, watching people activate a Gristlebrand when they have dredge cards in play and not decking themselves.
Oh, yeah. It actually, in dredge, it's fairly intricate trying to resolve a Gristlebrand activation because
yeah.
you, if you just dredge all of your Golgari Grave Trolls, you probably die.
Yeah. So when it comes to math, there's the speed aspect and being able to do these simple functions at a rate that doesn't impede your gameplay. But more importantly, you have to be able to do them accurately. There's so many times we've seen combo players miscount the amount of mana or the number of storm or their opponent's life total, and just these decks are one-shot things, and if you miscalculate that one shot, you basically lose on the spot.
Even in things like mono-red, where you need to push for lethal,
mm-hmm.
and you miscount, and you commit too many resources on a specific turn, and you don't get there, those are games that you're going to lose, just the same as with any other deck. You make mistakes in your math, and you lose.
You know, if you have to make the trade, we definitely err on the side of accuracy. The speed is also just, basically, you can't play slow. If you need to make these complicated attacks, or if you're trying to decide, is that lightning bolt plus my young pyromancer token going to be enough damage over the next two turns? Like, these kind of calculations need to be done at a certain level of proficiency.
And conveniently, it's fairly easy to practice the two things combined.
Yeah. Something I did in school that I attribute, like, my ability to do basic arithmetic quickly is something called Mad Minutes. We'll link to basically an online version of this, and they're just very simple multiplication, addition, subtraction, whatever you want. Just a sheet of them, basically, like 30 to 40 questions, and you have 60 seconds to do as many as possible. And it's just something you can do, you know, I don't know, 5 minutes, you'll do five of them. And honestly, if you practice anything on a regular basis, you really see gains. It's these small incremental improvements.
Absolutely. This is very similar to a bunch of the, like, math enrichment programs that kids these days do, Kumon or whatever. They all have similar things. So this is just a really great way of practicing your basic math. And honestly, basic math is most of what you need to know in Magic. If you're calculating probability on the spot, you're probably past the point of needing the basic math.
That's almost more of, like, learning kind of the general numbers, like tables and...
Yeah.
Rather than, like, writing out the hypergeometric distribution on the spot.
Well, I mean, I have certainly... I've certainly calculated probability on the spot in a match before, but...
Sure.
but yeah, it's a lot less applicable a lot of the time.
Yeah, and this is something, like... It may sound dumb, but honestly, if you want to play these kind of decks, or just in general, like, as a way of improving in Magic, it's, like, 2 minutes, 3 minutes out of your day that you can do, you know, maybe three or four times a week, even less. But if you just do it, rather than not doing it, you will improve.
It's also the kind of thing that you're not just learning this for the sake of being able to be good at math, at Magic, rather. Having basic arithmetic skills helps you in life,
yep,
not
that's true.
Just in Magic, right?
Yeah.
So
now, on the other hand, knowledge of the rules of Magic and knowledge of the card pool of Magic, that just helps you in Magic.
Sure, but then you get to really win the trivia games involving Magic the Gathering.
That's true. And if you win money during
ride?
Magic. Anyways, our next point, learning the rules of Magic.
So, I'm a judge, and the rules of Magic are often a little bit hard. They're just like...
There's a lot of them.
Yeah, there are a lot of rules.
The complexity lends itself to the replayability of the game.
Absolutely. So, something that I found is that there are lots of patterns within the rules. If you just understand how the rules work from sort of like a formulaic standpoint, you can really take an example from one point and then apply the same principles to other things, and they'll most likely function the same way.
Yeah.
And so there are a couple of, like, basic rules things. There are, like, there's priority-based stuff, state-based effects, triggers, activated abilities, replacement effects. Those are, like, the basic ones. And these are all things that you really need to know in order to play competitive Magic at all.
Yeah.
How each one of these things works. So priority is just every time anyone does anything, pretty much, each player will have priority before the thing resolves, except for land drops. State-based effects are checked any time that a player has priority. So this is something like Elesh Norn's static ability. If a creature has, like, damage on it or... Has zero toughness.
Well, I think what you're talking about is more, does the creature have damage equal to its toughness on it, or is the creature's toughness zero?
Yeah.
And Elesh Norn will cause this, and then the state-based effect says, you're dead.
Yeah, absolutely. And then we've got triggers, which people confuse with activated abilities a lot, and I don't really understand why, but a trigger is any time a card says when on it, basically. It's like, when or whenever something happens, do this.
Or, like, at the beginning of your upkeep.
Yeah.
It'll say at a point in time.
Yeah.
And then you do something.
Yeah.
Then we have activated abilities. Easiest thing with activated abilities is look where the colon is. Everything before the colon is the cost. That cannot be responded to. That's just what you're paying. And then everything after the colon is once the ability resolves after it's left the stack.
Yeah. And then there are replacement effects, which are... Replacement effects are anytime something says as on it or instead of.
Yeah, I think replacement effects are almost the easiest thing because it's literally you're doing something instead of something else.
Yeah. You cannot miss them.
Yeah. They must be done this way.
Yeah, and they are mandatory. You can't miss them at all.
So just a quick rundown of examples in Legacy. For priority, look at, say you're playing against a person with Aether Vial. And during your end step, they activate the Aether Vial and they put a dude into play. And then they want to untap immediately. So that they can protect their dude. That's not how priority works.
Yeah, I had to deal with a very salty player at a tournament recently who appealed my judge call about that. Yeah, that was...
So basically, like, anytime you do anything that involves the stack, there is a passing of priority back and forth until the stack is clear. In this instance, the vial be activated, priority gets passed back and forth, the vial resolves, now priority gets passed back and forth again. Then once that happens, then the phase is over. You go to the next phase.
Basically, phases change whenever the active player would like to pass into the next phase without doing anything else.
Yeah.
And so then they would pass priority, and then the opponent would have a chance to do anything before the next phase happens.
And once both people do nothing, and they both pass, then we go to the next phase.
Yeah.
State-based effects, we have a classic example of Lightning Bolt versus Tarmogoyf.
Don't bolt 2-3 Goyfs when there aren't instants in the graveyard.
That's the basic gist of it, but I don't think we're going to learn much about state-based effects that way. Can you delve deeper into this?
Okay, so the reason that this is the case. So assume that you have a land and a sorcery in your graveyard, or in your communal graveyards.
Yep.
There's a Tarmogoyf in play.
Yep.
It's a 2-3, and you have a Lightning Bolt. You bolt the Goyf.
Yes.
So what happens...
Value.
...is because the Tarmogoyf has just, like, this attribute, which is has power and toughness equal to... number of card types in graveyards with an extra toughness. When state-based effects are checked, which is whenever somebody has priority after the Lightning Bolt is resolved, the Tarmogoyf is going to be a 3-4 with 3 damage marked on it.
Yeah.
And so even though you bolted a 3 toughness creature, once the Lightning Bolt resolves, it's no longer a 3 toughness creature, and it won't die.
Yeah, just to elaborate, basically what's happening is you have a 2-3 Tarmogoyf, Lightning Bolt goes on the stack targeting Tarmogoyf. As part of the resolution of Lightning Bolt, 3 damage goes onto the Tarmogoyf, and the Lightning Bolt goes to the graveyard. So these things happen at the same time before state-based effects are checked. Then once both of those things happen, state-based effects are checked, Tarmogoyf's power and toughness just move instantly. Like, yeah. What do you call it, a static ability?
It's not a static ability, it's just like, basically just...
It just always is.
Yeah.
Actually, Tarmogoyf's super interesting because it's also that way in your library.
Yeah, Tarmogoyf's a weird
card. Tarmogoyf's a weird card. Stars in Magic are weird. But anyways...
I think there's a reason that they don't do them as much anymore.
Anyways, the point is, at no point in time is the Lightning Bolt not in the graveyard or the Tarmogoyf has sufficient toughness and damage. That was a bad way of putting this. All I'm trying to say is, Bolt enters the graveyard at the same time as the damage is checked.
Yeah.
Which means that Tarmogoyf is a 3-4.
I think more specifically, the Lightning Bolt is already in the graveyard when the damage is checked.
So that's a very classic example of Lightning Bolts don't kill players, state-based effects kill players.
Yep.
For triggers, are there such things as detrimental and beneficial triggers?
Technically, yes.
Mm-hmm.
In competitive Magic, effectively, no.
Okay.
So, basically...
What does that mean?
So, basically, whenever you miss a trigger, you've missed it, and it is then your opponent's decision whether or not they would like to put it on the stack.
Okay.
So... Let's say I miss my Dark Confidant trigger.
Yep.
People have been debating whether or not this is a beneficial or detrimental trigger for years, ever since the card was printed.
Mm-hmm.
I miss it. I'm sitting across the table from you. You have a Lightning Bolt in hand, and I'm at 5 life. You want me to reveal a card to the Dark Confidant.
Put that trigger on the stack.
Right? Whether or not we're just going to assume that I didn't intentionally miss it, because that's cheating. Don't cheat.
Yep.
If you miss a trigger that it is situationally bad for you,
if you miss any trigger intentionally, that is a violation of the rules.
Yeah, unless the trigger says may.
Yeah, yeah, but that's, I mean, like, any trigger that doesn't... Yeah,
yeah, okay. Yeah. You can intentionally miss triggers. Doing so is cheating. Don't do that. Basically, assuming you're playing with good intent, if you miss a trigger, it doesn't matter whether it was a beneficial or detrimental trigger, because it's your opponent's decision whether to put it on the stack, and your opponent will probably elect not to.
So those distinctions of beneficial and detrimental are more for determining intent of cheating?
Yeah, I think they're more for judge benefit.
Okay. Just on this subject, we want to briefly cover the acronym of APNAP, or Active Player, Non-Active Player.
So this was a really sweet interaction. Not really sweet. For anyone who played Standard with Boros Reckoner and Blasphemous Act, basically, Boros Reckoner is a card that reads, whenever it's dealt damage, deal that much damage to target creature or player. And Blasphemous Act is a card that reads, deal 13 damage to each creature on the battlefield. And so, what happened in Mono Red Mirrors was people would have this, like, combo where they would like have Boros Reckoner and Blasphemous Act in play, mm-hmm. And they'd cast Blasphemous Act and they have Boros Reckoner and then they deal 13 damage to their opponent. It was like an OTK, like,
sure, yeah,
deal
yeah.
you a bunch of damage, kill combo. And so what would happen is if somebody had if each player had a Boros Reckoner in play, mm-hmm. and one person cast Blasphemous Act and they were both at less than 13 life, mm-hmm. the player who cast the Blasphemous Act would lose.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is that APNAP stands for active player, non-active player. And so the Blasphemous Act would go on the stack, deal 13 damage to everything, and then the active player's trigger, the Boros Reckoner trigger, would go on the stack, and then the non-active player, so the person who didn't cast Blasphemous Act, their Boros Reckoner trigger would go on the stack on top of it. And so the stack resolves top to bottom, first in, last out.
Yeah.
And so the person whose trigger went on last would resolve first, deal 13 damage to their opponent. Their opponent would drop 13 life, and then state-based effects would be checked.
Yep, you're dead.
Before the next Boros Reckoner trigger goes on the stack, and you'd die.
Yeah, this is for whenever... This is basically just covers trigger... Well, I mean, we're talking about triggers, but it's for when things go on the stack at the same time.
Specifically multiple players' effects at the same time.
Yeah.
Because if it's just all your triggers, you can put them on the stack in any way you want.
Yeah. No, the important thing is to just remember, the active player is the player whose turn it is.
Yeah.
So, a Blasphemous Act being a sorcery, like, if it were an instant, then you'd get these really weird situations where you only want to cast it on your opponent's turn, because then you're the non-active player, and your Boros Reckoner would resolve first.
Yeah.
So, what it basically means is, active player, non-active player, if it's your turn, like, you're the active player, and both you and your opponent have triggers that go on at the same time, yours will resolve last.
Which can be good or bad, depending.
Yeah.
So it's just a matter of...
you just need to be aware that this is what happens.
Yeah. It's important.
We've talked about activated abilities, but just a common thing in Legacy that kind of explains things. Aether Vial, once again. The tap is the... Before the colon, this is what is required to activate the ability. And then everything else happens...
afterwards.
And that's the resolution of the ability.
Yeah, so Aether Vial... Basically, you put in a creature when the ability resolves.
Yes. So this means I tap my Aether Vial. This is putting the ability on the stack. I pass priority to Matt. Matt elects to...
I go, cool, sure.
Awesome.
It's my end step, I assume.
Yeah, sure.
You put in Thalia.
Yep.
And then I'm like, wait, before Thalia comes in, I want to cast this spell.
It's like, nope.
It is too late.
This is the resolution of the ability. That's just, it's happened. You'll see this a lot. You put in a Revoker. They want to flip their top in response. Too late. It's already in play. It's already naming Sensei's Divining Top.
Yeah. Or, like, any other activated ability, whether that's a Deathrite Shaman or...
Yeah. So, yeah, like, let's talk about Deathrite Shaman quickly, because I think there's some interesting examples of activated abilities here.
So, Deathrite Shaman exiles the cards as part of the resolution of the latter two abilities.
Yes.
So, the Drain Your Opponents and Gain 2 Life, those are both... basically abilities that you are exiling a card and doing the gain or drain effect.
And because they have a target, that means if that target, the card in the graveyard, for some reason leaves that zone...
the ability is countered upon resolution
because
it no longer has a target and will not resolve.
Yeah. So if you have a Deathrite Shaman and I have a Deathrite Shaman, it's basically a game of chicken.
Yeah.
Because if you target the land that's in my graveyard, I can eat it in response and then you don't get the mana. If I target the creature in your graveyard to gain life, you can eat it in response, and then I don't gain life.
Yeah. Deathrite Shaman is weird when you're playing against other Deathrite Shamans.
Yeah, it's just... But it's knowing that that is part of the resolution of the ability. Now, if you look at Grim Lavamancer...
Yeah.
Grim Lavamancer, say you have a Grim Lavamancer and two cards in your graveyard, and I go to try and eat one with a Deathrite Shaman.
I can then just exile both cards with my Grim Lavamancer as part of the ability.
Yeah.
And then the two damage will go on the stack.
Yeah, or even you could look at it this way, like, you can go to activate Grim Lavamancer, targeting whatever, my Deathrite Shaman perhaps, but those cards are instantly removed, so I can no longer eat them with the Deathrite Shaman in an attempt to gain life or prevent you from activating your Lavamancer, etc. Another one is, this one comes up actually a bit, is Stifle, Fetchlands, and Deathrite Shaman.
Yeah, so... I had a friend the other day who made this mistake. He was trying to play around Stifle. His opponent had upkeep brainstormed. His opponent had one land and a Deathrite Shaman in play. There were no lands in the graveyard. Playing Bug Delver versus Jund. And so the Jund player waits until... The bug player tapped out, has a Deathrite Shaman in play. It's his own upkeep.
Yeah.
Brainstormed on upkeep to flip his Delver.
Sure.
Has a Deathrite Shaman untapped, but no second land.
Yeah, and there's no lands in the graveyard.
So the junk player, during his opponent's draw step, fetches in the effort to play around Stifle, but that doesn't actually do anything, because the Deathrite Shaman can exile the land while the ability's still in the stack, because sacrifice your fetch land is part of the cost of fetching.
So that means for the search to go on the stack, the land's already in the graveyard, which means the Deathrite can eat it to interact with.
Replacement effects are basically things like Dredge. So if you were to draw, instead you may move this card from your graveyard to your hand and mill the top X cards of your library. So this is a very simple replacement effect. You're replacing your draw step with something else. Or you're just replacing your draw, rather.
Yeah. So the important thing here is that it doesn't use the stack. So during your draw step, like, that draw never goes on the stack. It's just at the beginning of your draw step. But say you cast Careful Study, right? If you let that Careful Study resolve, you can interact before it, like while the Careful Study's on the stack. But if you let it resolve during the resolution of the spell, your opponent can choose to dredge 6 and then draw a card, or draw a card and then dredge, or dredge twice, depending on their graveyard. But at no point do you get to say, like, I want to interact
while you're in the middle of dredging or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. Replacement effects, basically you can't interact with them. They basically just don't use the stack. So Iona and True Name Nemesis are both, their Enter the Battlefield abilities are not Enter the Battlefield abilities. They're replacing ability. I don't know.
They're just categorized as such.
Yeah.
It just means they don't go on the stack. They just happen. They can't be missed.
I kind of feel like they're both poorly designed cards for that reason, because they're basically just like Enter the Battlefield triggers, except they're not triggers.
I don't think that's bad design, though, because then you can't miss them.
Yeah, sure. It's just like, I don't know.
The other type of knowledge when it comes to Magic besides the rules is knowledge of all the different cards. This game's existed for a long, long time at this point, and there's a lot of cards, especially when it comes to Legacy. So being familiar with, at the very least, the most commonly played cards, like knowing how Brainstorm works, knowing how Force of Will works, this is just like a very basic thing, and as you continue to play the format, you're going to be more familiar with more and more cards, including the fringe cards. And this is just kind of, you're developing your vocabulary for playing the game.
Yeah, it's the same way that you would be developing your vocabulary for language.
Mm-hmm. Once you learn the basic card pool, you start looking at chunks of them as decks. And this isn't, it's important when I say this to not just look at the 60 card main decks, but also look at the sideboards.
Sideboards are so important. People overlook sideboards far too much.
Yeah, especially when we're playing 2/3 of our games post-board versus pre-board. It's just, sideboards are important, and they're real people too, and they matter. And just look at the 75s versus the 60s.
It's not 2/3. It's less than 2/3.
Sure. Up to 2/3.
Yeah.
A good way of doing this is looking at tournament results, looking at deck lists for that, and just, it's familiarizing yourself with the metagame. So you look at what happened at Star City last weekend. We saw Goblins won, which was cool. You also see that this is a Goblins deck not playing Thalia. This is, it's Boshing Black, it's playing Chalice of the Void out of the board.
And Grenzo. Grenzo's sweet.
Grenzo's cool. Earwig Squad is amazing. and you look at, there was a tournament report the guy did, and he did a write-up on basically what was good, what wasn't. He said that Warping Whale was good, he just couldn't find room for a second copy. Chalice of the Void vastly overperformed out of the board, which I totally believe.
I mean, the card's very, very powerful.
Yeah. Well, it's also really cool because you're playing Vile and you're playing Cavern, so you can cheat through your own Chalice. Plus, it's a piece of combo hate that you don't have to splash for. Whereas, like, when you were playing Thalia before, it was kind of awkward.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, after we familiarize yourself with the card pool and the decks, you start looking at play patterns and openings. This is a really big part of Legacy because the games are kind of condensed into a smaller number of turns. Or, if not, the opening turns matter a lot.
Yeah, very much so. Knowing what your opponent's playing can really sculpt your own game plan. And so, correctly analyzing what they're on at the very, very beginning, as soon as turn one, is extremely important for basically your card selection. You'll often want to cantrip into things or away from things, depending on what your opponent's playing. And so if someone leads turn one Vile off of a Plains they're probably on D&T.
Yep.
Like, 100%. But if they lead turn one Aether Vial off of a Wasteland, they could be one of three decks, being D&T, Goblins, or Merfolk.
Yep.
As opposed to, like, Planes Go or Planes Mom.
Yeah.
Or something like that. And then you would even read into that even more. Like, if your opponent just goes Planes Go, they're probably one of two decks, either Miracles or D&T. And they're much more likely to be D&T.
Yeah.
And then you can read into what their hand probably consists of. What would you think their hand would consist of?
I mean, if you're a D&T player and you kept Planes Go as your opening, you have to have some very powerful 2-drops, or just... There's got to be a reason to keep the hand, right? So if they have a Thalia, if they have a Stoneforge, if they have both these cards, if they have a number of Wastelands that they want to get you with, these are all things that they could have. But you kind of have to take that, the fact that they're going Planes Go in a deck that has very, very powerful 1-drops that they want, and they're keeping a hand that doesn't have them.
Yeah, at the same time, they do only have the 8 1-drops that they would be proactively playing, so that's something to consider, that they might just not have it.
Yep.
But I think that more often they will just have more powerful 2-drops and a high concentration of them.
Yeah, and the other thing is now D&T is a deck that really benefits from the Scry rule, so they are kind of encouraged from mulliganing a little bit more aggressively, or they have the option to find those better hands.
The Scry rule is great. People really don't mulligan enough.
I also think this is a friendly reminder, just do it. I've seen so many people miss it in tournament play.
Yeah, yeah. You can miss it. It's a trigger.
Yeah.
It's your obligation to remember it and take advantage from your Scry.
Another just opening I wanted to mention was the Wooded Foothills, then Pass the Turn.
Yeah, so this is really interesting, because it's a fairly strong indication of a very specific deck, and a very specific card in your opponent's hand in their deck. And, you know, I kind of feel like we should continue the episode and then come back to this.
Sure. So just when we're looking to improve with the knowledge of these openings and whatnot, you best way to do it is just watch coverage. Watch other people's matches, be it online, a stream or something, or just when you're at a tournament in between rounds, watching other players and see what they do in these situations.
Yeah, I would definitely go back and watch all of Owen Turtenwald's videos ever.
Yes. What are you, Owen Turtenwald?
No. But maybe I'm an Owen Turtenwald wannabe? No, I'm not. So, evaluation.
This is a...
It's the most intangible of all of the fundamentals, I think.
And yet it's one of the...
It's the most important. I think it's the most important.
Yeah.
So...
What do we mean by evaluation?
It's really just, like, analyzing a game state or analyzing cards, analyzing your deck list, and just, like, making conclusions based off of that. Coming to conclusions and then being able to make decisions based off of that.
Yeah.
So whether or not you're looking at a board state where you've got a bunch of creatures and your opponent has a bunch of creatures and you want to know whether or not it's beneficial to attack this turn and with how many creatures, that's a sort of evaluation.
Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of evaluation that you do a lot in, like, I think it's similar to chess. That's where it, like, the game is the most similar to chess, where you're just, like, doing stuff on board and...
It's taking a look at the board, looking at the number of outcomes that are very similar yet not the same, and what you think the best one is for you.
Yeah. So, the thing about the analysis and evaluation of these kinds of things is that it's not... You can never be 100% correct.
Yeah, Magic's not a perfect game like chess.
Yeah. You're also not going to know how correct you were. Like, even looking back retrospectively, you're not going to be able to tell what line was correct.
Yeah.
People often say that they, like, took the right line because they drew this card, and that's not the right approach to take.
No.
Because you were whatever percentage to draw that card, and, like...
What's there's a statistical term for when the outcome influences the way you look at it.
20/20 hindsight?
Yeah, it's not basically. Like, I don't know.
Basically,
Magic has a ton of hidden information, and it's not just, like, your opponent's hand you can't see, it's the fact that you can't see the top card of your library or your opponent's library, or at any point, like, you just see the cards in your hand and the cards on the board, and that means there's probably another 90 cards, 100 cards you don't see.
Yeah. It's really funny, because you can, like, a computer would be able to play Magic, but they probably wouldn't be able to play it as well, because unless they basically would just have to take lines assuming highest probabilities.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're just taking all the lines of the highest probability, you're not necessarily taking winning lines.
Yep.
Often you have to take a line that has a much lower probability of success because it's the only way you're winning the game.
Yeah.
You need to hit your, like, 2% out instead of your 20% out to survive another turn.
Yeah, I think that's a big distinction we should make, is there's a difference between playing to win and playing to not lose.
Yeah.
So, yes, I can make a block like this, this, and this, and I will go down to 5 instead of, like, going to 1. Or going, let's say, going to lightning bolt range and being dead to the burn that they probably have. The thing is, if you always make this block, what are the chances you can draw a card that you can win on the crackback with? Right? Like, if your board gets wiped and then it doesn't matter if they have the bolt or not, you're just dead on the next turn because they'll attack you again. Whereas if you play to these little outs and understanding that this is the only way you can actually win the game versus not losing for the next 3 turns, like, it's a big distinction, and it's definitely like a level up moment when you have those realizations.
Yeah, it very much is. I think that I got to that point about a year and a half ago, and before that I just didn't understand it, and I just always played to not lose.
Yeah.
And I lost a lot of games because I played to not lose.
Yeah. So, what is, like, the information that you have at your disposal? You have your deck, you have your opponent's deck, or what you think your opponent's deck is.
Which you can often probably deduce down to, like, a couple of cards.
Mm-hmm.
Just based off of metagames and studying deck lists.
So you have the cards in your hand, you have what's on the board, and then we have what we call intangibles, like how your opponent's been acting, how long they take to respond to certain things.
Yeah, and so these are all things that your opponent can intentionally try and mislead you with.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's all about your ability to read your opponent.
And... But it's just other information that you need to be aware of.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So the fact that you have all these different things, and the fact that Legacy is a format where you have these cantrips, and this information's constantly changing, means, once again, it's very hard to determine a line that's just, like, 100% this is what you should do. So it's about figuring out the best possible outcome, given what you know.
Yeah, I like that.
And that's always changing.
Yeah, it absolutely is always changing. Oh, another thing. It's really interesting, the farther you get into a game, the more information you have,
yes,
the more able you are to read what your opponent has. If they've been playing a certain way for, like, 5 turns, and they go through some number of cards, you're fairly certain that they have... The number of... the different cards that they have is going to be limited to a much smaller pool. Despite being, like, some number of cards out of 60 cards, you can probably deduce that down to, like, a couple of different specific cards.
Yeah, if we're playing a long drawn-out game, and you keep, like, say, 2 cards in your hand at all times, and you're on Shardless. Best bet is that these are reactive spells, right? Like, you could probably have an Abrupt Decay or a Force of Will. Maybe a Maelstrom Pulse. Like, things like that. Because Shardless is the type of deck where, if we're in this long drawn-out state, it just benefits you to, generally speaking, play out your threats. Like, your Shardless agents you're leaning on is, they get advantage when they're on board, not in your hand.
Yeah, the deck really plays the board.
Yeah, so if you're holding these cards in your hand, like, you have 2 cards for the, like, 5 turns where we're just going back and forth, it's probably one of these things.
Yeah, another interesting thing is that Brainstorm really changes the dynamic of this. So you can go from knowing what your opponent has. Like,
yeah.
You can go from either, like, directly knowing what they have from some sort of an information spell,
yeah,
or just having deduced what they have based on their play patterns, and then they'll cast a Brainstorm, and all of a sudden they have a different hand. And so you don't necessarily know as much. So keeping that in mind is really important.
When it comes to that, I think a good way of improving on that is whenever you're playtesting, if it gets to those points where you're... Actually, it doesn't matter. At any point, you can just stop the game and kind of talk about, what do you think I have in my hand? What do I think you have in your hand? And kind of logicking it out loud really helps out.
It really improves the deductive skills and on-the-fly deductive skills.
Yeah.
Which is really important. Again, as with the basic math, it's just a matter of practice, and it's just like, it's exercise.
Yeah.
With anything else.
A common theme we're going to see with evaluations, the best way to improve on it is discussion. And it's discussion with your friends, it's discussion with whoever you're playtesting with, talking with your opponents after a match. Like, if there was there's a critical moment where you made a decision that could have gone one way or the other, talking about that, I mean, most people will be happy to.
Unless they're salty.
Sure. Yeah, yeah. But I mean, if you don't talk about it, you're not going to get that information.
Absolutely. I think the real key is just like multiple perspectives.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't get hive-minded.
Yeah, it's really important not to have just like a very sort of like homogenous set of opinions among your playgroup as well.
Yeah.
Because that really just leads to a lot of inbreeding and not very much real like improvement or innovation.
So another form of evaluation, we have the classic, who is the beatdown?
So the best way to illustrate this is with mono red mirrors.
Mm-hmm.
You're playing like a deck with some creatures and some burn spells.
Yeah.
And your goal is to win the game by reducing your opponent to zero.
Mm-hmm.
And you're playing the mirror. Who is the beatdown is basically just, am I going to use my lightning bolt on your face or your creature? Am I trying to control the board and play a long grindy game with you and like kill you with my creatures or my repeated damage spells? Or am I like trying to not die because your creatures are going to kill me?
Yeah.
Or am I the beatdown? I'm ahead on board, I'm ahead on resources or whatever, and I'm just on life, yeah. And I'm just trying to bolt you to death.
Yeah.
Right. And so there are going to be more nuanced situations than in Mono Red Mirrors. But Mono Red, like, is a nuanced deck.
Yeah, I don't know if nuance is the right situation. I think Who's the Beatdown is best illustrated in a mirror where you both have the same resources, and you have to decide how to use those resources. If you're playing, like, I don't know, Miracles versus Burn, it's very clear, like, who's the beatdown and who's the control deck.
Yeah.
So, it's just the way decks are built kind of dictate who's the beatdown, and it becomes more ambiguous in the mirror, and that's where the ability to decide who it is very important. Because you will win and lose games on the back of, that bolt should have gone to a creature rather than your face.
A great deck to illustrate, like, a deck that is really good at this regardless of what the matchup is Blue-White Red Control in Modern. Mm. Because they're just playing, they're a control deck, but they're playing 8 Lightning Bolt effects, and Snapcaster Mages, and Vanillin Cleeks, and Restoration Angels, and so they can just turn a corner really quickly and just become the beatdown, and close the game out. And yeah. They can also just start the game as the beatdown against, like, a lot of the degenerate combo decks of the format.
Yeah, Ambush Viper.
Oh, yeah. Number of times that I've beaten Tron with Blight Red, where you just, like, open with turn 2 Snapcaster Mage on their end step, is much higher than the games that I didn't open with that.
Yeah.
It's really important.
Another thing to evaluate, of course, is mulligans, your opening hand. This is something you have a lot of control over. So this is actually almost something you can practice, is just drawing your opening hands with the whatever deck you play and saying, you can give yourself parameters like, this is a game one where I don't know what my opponent's playing, or this is a game one where I know, like, I recognize a local player and I know he's on this. Is this hand good enough to keep against that specific archetype? Or you can even board and say, like, okay, I've boarded my deck. I'm playing post-board game 2 versus Storm. Can I win?
Yeah. I think that people just don't mulligan enough in general. So mulliganing more, it can hurt, but it also can improve.
I got that fancy new Scry rule.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, take advantage of it. The Scry rule's great.
Yeah, so like an example of a very linear deck where mulligan's important, a turn 1 combo deck of Goblin Charbelcher. You need to have, you know, all the mana to cast your Empty the Warrens or Charbelcher. And it's very tempting to keep a hand that's, say, like, 6 pieces of mana and a Cataxian Probe.
But the likelihood of you drawing a piece of action off of your Cataxian Probe is fairly minimal.
Yeah, even if you keep, like, the 2 Cataxian Probes, it's like, these are suspect hands, and I think you have to be disciplined about mulliganing them. Conversely, like, Belcher's a deck of critical mass. So say you're on a mull of 5, you might have to keep a fiver that's mostly mana, or all mana, just because you can't win on a mull of 4.
So then we've got sideboarding, which is just like an evaluation of whether or not a card is good, and why a card is good. Mm-hmm. So something that Mike and I do a lot, which is very unintuitive to most players, is whenever we're playing a white-blue control deck of some kind in Legacy, we board in our Containment Priest against every combo deck.
Pretty much.
The reason for that is even though Containment Priest isn't actually a card that deals with Storm in any way, shape, or form,
nope.
You still just get to end step it, and then you have a clock, and you got to hold up counter magic, potentially. Yeah. Whether you're playing Spell Pierce, Fluster Storm, Counterspell, any of those types of cards, it just enables you to make better use of your mana, and it also just enables you to have a clock.
Yeah, the important things to beat combo decks are being able to hold up counter magic and be able to end the game and not let them just overwhelm you.
Yeah. Most of the combo decks will be able to sculpt a 7 that can beat pretty much any 7 that you have, unless you don't give them time.
Yeah.
That's the real key, is you just have to be able to beat them before they can beat you.
Mm-hmm.
And then yeah. So, like, a perfect 7-card storm hand with some number of cards in the graveyard in Ant will be able to beat almost anything that doesn't have, like, lock pieces in play.
Yeah. So, the other thing is, you look at, we know, say we're playing Delver, and we're playing against Sneak and Show. We know we're bringing in Pyroblast because it's a good card and it counters Show and Tell. But the use of Pyroblast in against a combo deck, it comes in two forms. You can attack their gas, or you can attack their cantrips, their ability to set up, find their gas, or find protection for it. It's a very dynamic card, and you have to figure out, is it better for me to save this for the counter fight that inevitably is going to happen around them trying to go off? Or is it better for me to attack their turn one Ponder so that they can't set up?
Yeah, a really good example of this, not using Pyroblast, but I was playing Omnitel against Jacob Wilson at an open, and he was just aggressively, like, force of willing my cantrips.
Yeah.
He just, like, got a threat into play and then just fought over every single one of my cantrips, and I just died because I couldn't assemble anything because I was just basically drawing off the top like a peasant.
Yep. That kind of became consensus about how to beat Omni. It's like, yeah, even though it's really counterintuitive. It's a deck that's, like, 16 cantrips and some dig-through times. But if you counter their cantrips, they can't set up, they can't even find the dig-through time.
Yeah.
They draw, you know, their fourth show and tell, their fifth land, and they're just sad.
Yeah. So it's really interesting that that's the way that you want to attack these cantrip-based combo decks.
Yeah.
A lot of the time. And sometimes that's not the way you want to do it, but I think a lot of the time that is.
Yeah. Yeah, like, Omni was just a deck that could fight you if it got to set up. Like, we were talking about Storm before. It's like, it doesn't matter how much counter magic you have. They have, you know, just as many spell pierces and pyroblasts and forces.
Yeah.
Just in closing with evaluation, it's rarely linear. Like, this is not something where you can look back and go, oh yeah, this is what I should have done. Sometimes it is, but most of the time it's a matter of looking at different lines, being able to defend them and say, like, this is good because of this, or this is good because of that. In the long term, you're trying to develop, your intuition, your ability to look at a game and just instinctively know, this is what I want to do here.
And intuition is great. Like, I'm a very strong intuitive player and very much weaker analytical player, which is both a good thing and a bad thing.
Yep.
And so it's very important to be able to trust your intuition to an extent, but also know when it's misleading you.
Yeah.
Because it's sometimes going to be wrong because magic's not always the same.
Yeah.
So I think that we should take a moment and go back to the Wooded Foothills opening.
Okay.
Now that we're done talking about evaluation.
Yeah.
I feel like this is an appropriate spot. So I hope now that everyone's had a chance to really think about that opening. If your opponent just leads Wooded Foothills Pass, what deck is that? I've got a deck in mind, and I have a specific card that I think my opponent would have in hand.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty sure that they're playing Rug Delver.
Yeah.
And that they're holding Stifle.
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of a classic. Other decks that have Wooded Foothill. We have Lands. Lands going Wooded Foothill go, very weird. Very bad keep.
Maybe if they've mulled to, like, four or
Goblins?
Something. Goblins.
Very weird hand, very bad keep.
Yeah.
Like, you want a Lackey, you want a Vial, like, you want something. Could
Infect.
Infect, yep. Any green fetch can be Infect. Any green fetch can be Elves. Elves with no one drop.
That seems absurd,
just seems bad. Like, I don't know what they're doing. Infect, same thing. Like, Infect wants to have something on turn one, be it a Noble Hierarch, Glistener, Elf, a cantrip. Like, they're a deck that tries to get you in the early
game. I mean, they could also be doing this, taking the same they line as Rug Delver, where they're like,
but
pass the turn with Stifle up if they drew the one of.
Yeah. Basically, what it comes down to is Wooded Foothills, the decks that traditionally play it, like four green or red mana, are decks that want something on turn one. So playing that and then passing, very weird. Rug Delver, coincidentally, because it fetches both Tropical and Volcanic, and Rug doesn't play any basics, you can play four Wooded Foothills and it works just fine. And sometimes you can just get people. Like, if I was, say I went Flooded Strand go, and they went Wooded Foothills go, all of a sudden I'm like,
should have fetched Main Face.
Really upset with myself.
Yeah.
Played around Wasteland, did not play around Stifle.
It's a really tough dynamic because your opponent could have either. You have to make the read, especially if you're on the play and you know you're playing against Rug Delver.
Yeah.
All right. So then we get into mental state. And this is something that I think is really, really important. I think this is the second most important thing.
Yeah.
And this is just a matter of being composed. A lot of the time it's just a matter of, like, reflection and knowing when you're being rational.
Because
magic players get irrational. I get irrational. You get irrational. We go on tilt. It's a thing that happens. And so you just have to, like, really, really just make sure that you are at your best mentally speaking.
Yeah. I mean, Magic is a mental game. So if you're not in the right state of mind to compete or, like, to concentrate for 50 minutes straight in a match, if you're thinking about other things, it's another hindrance you have besides, like, your opponent trying to beat you.
Yeah, I mean, if it's not a mental game and it's not a technical game, then are we just high-rolling for everything?
Yes! Like... I mean, there's a little bit of that.
Sure. Mostly after dinner Magic players.
Yeah, with credit cards.
Oh, God. I don't ever do that.
I mean, okay. Mental state, you want to have good habits. The trick to good habits is that... Let's back up. Bad habits, you can't stop. Like, you can't tell your brain to not do something.
Yeah, you have to replace it with something.
Exactly. So
it's kind of like when you delete a file on your computer. file is actually still there.
Yeah, but it's ready just, to be written over.
Yeah, basically. So you need to write over it with something else.
Mm-hmm. So we want to create good habits. The way you can do this, you just have to remind yourself to do it every time. We look at something like missing triggers. This is a very easy one to fix, I find. In Legacy, look at, like, I don't know, Bob, Eidolon of the Great Revel, Counterbalance, Chalice of the Void. These are things where you're very important to whatever deck you're playing them in. And if you miss their triggers, then they're not doing what they're supposed to do.
Yeah, I think my win percentage against Chalice of the Void is, like, a lot higher than it should be. Because I think my opponents have missed, like, 20% of their Chalice triggers.
Yeah, because Chalice doesn't say you can't cast spells of the CMC. It says... when they cast it, there's a trigger, and if the trigger's remembered, that spell gets countered.
Pretty sure that's the same with Nether Void.
Not sure. Our record with rules interactions from cards from Legends is not good.
Yeah, it's not. So we're gonna not say anything specific
we'll skip
on that.
Yeah. But yeah, so what I've done is, and I know I stole this from the guys at, what was it, TCG Player? Or no, Ultra Pro, the Mike Flores team. Whenever they miss a trigger, you do 10 push-ups. And you're either really fit at the end of it, or at the very least, you don't miss your Eidolon triggers.
Yeah. Obviously, this is less of a detrimental thing to do if you're already fit.
Yeah, but it's just...
But also Magic players.
The idea is to do something to remind yourself that you're trying to fix the habit.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And the only way you do that is by constantly reinforcing that you need to do this one thing. So tilt... Tilt's always fun. We talked a little bit about this before.
I think we talked, like, a fair amount about tilt before.
Yeah.
But I think the way to improve your tilt is just to try and change your perspective by looking at things positively.
Yep.
And so you can look at it in a matter of, I drew poorly, my opponent drew well, they hit their whatever percentage, I'm salty about this. Or you can be like, how could I have maximized this? What did I potentially do wrong? How do I learn from this? And just, like, making sure that you have the right mindset about it is really, really important. Like, I used to go on quite a bit of tilt, and then I just, like, started thinking about every match as, I don't care about whether I'm winning or losing this match, I care about learning.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I'm playing this match. And like, even like, Grand Prix, like, yeah, it wasn't... It's nice to win.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like, I actually do enjoy losing, because then I know that there are things that I did wrong, and I can fix. Right? It's a lot harder to look at games that you won and try and fix things that you made mistakes in.
That's an important thing to do. I think people, once they win, they're like, oh yeah, easy, I just did this, this, and this. And they didn't look back and say, I should have done these things, or this was definitely a mistake and I got away with it.
I think it's really interesting, the number of times that you hear Magic players say, I won because I played perfectly, or I lost because of variance.
Yep.
And I think that people just need to stop making excuses.
Yep.
Really. You are accountable for your results. To a certain extent. Like, I think the extent that you're responsible for your result in a tournament is extremely high. Like, if you were to put a percentage to it, it's, like, I would say it's higher than 80% easily.
Yeah, you're vastly responsible for yourself.
I think that you can mitigate variance down to a point of, like, 10 to 15%, if that. I think that that's... It's just a matter of, like, yeah, you just try and mitigate it as in any way you can by playing cantrips, by mulliganing correctly...
Well, yeah,
it's consistent decks.
When we talk about tilt and variance, the important thing is that you look back and don't worry that your opponent drew well or you drew poorly. Think about the things that you can control and that you can improve on. Think, okay, you know, I didn't get a great night's sleep last night. I could have done that, and that way I would have played better. I could have mulliganed this hand that was like a 50-50 to get there. There's all these things that you have control over, and those are the things you should focus on improving. Don't try to get your opponents to mull a 3 to win every game. Don't try and, like, just have the the nut draw that when you need it, it's like, think about all these other things that are actually within your control.
Yeah, like if you're counting on a nut draw, then think about how you can maximize your nut draw by building your deck in such a way that you just have a large number of nut draws.
Yeah.
Like, these are all things that you can do.
And just as like a, I don't know, a PSA when it comes to Magic, this is a game with random elements, and if you are uncomfortable with that, there's so many other fun games you can play.
Just play chess.
You need to be able to kind of reconcile the fact that you will lose games due to nothing short of luck.
Yeah.
We just finished talking about how there's a lot of stuff within your control, and you should focus on that. At the same time, you need to be able to walk away from a tournament and say, not my day.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't know what that feels like, because I just Vampiric Tutor every turn.
Yeah. Some people.
yeah. So we've got, like, you have to have a lot of confidence when you're playing Magic. I think some of that is just coming back to, like, you need to be in the moment when you play.
Mm.
Don't think about other things. I remember I was playing in a WMCQ, mm-hmm. and I got to 6-0, and it was, like, an 8 or 9 round tournament. And so I was just, like, I was undefeated. I was in, like, extremely good position to make top 8.
Oh, it's the winning in mindset.
Yeah, it was the winning in mindset. Yes. And then I just, like, played 2 rounds in a row, and I lost both of them because of just, like, I was thinking too much about, like, I want this top 8, how do I get, like, I stopped thinking about the game, and I made mistakes, and I lost, and it was just, like, I wasn't in the moment, I didn't think about the game, I didn't put it out of my mind, and I really learned from that experience. I then played in Grand Prix New Jersey last year, and I didn't lose concentration until round 9, and that was the first round that I lost, unfortunately. But
humble brags.
No. But like it, I think yeah, that like no, it was totally entirely right. Because of the composure that I had, and I just like it was just all about focus.
Yep.
I played against like a couple of like big name players, and that would like that's the kind of thing that's intimidating, right? Like you go from not like playing against people from your local town or whatever, and then you play against like people who are like in
name
pro
players.
Yeah, name players, like pro tour people, and it's just like it can be scary, but you just have to like focus on the game,
mm-hmm.
right? It's just really important. They're players like anyone else.
Confidence also comes down to when we're evaluating lines. If you're not confident that this will get you there, then you're going to be way less willing to pull the trigger on a line that's perfectly reasonable and will like has potential to win you the game.
Yeah.
Like, we look at Infect as a deck. This is a deck that you need to kind of be able to have the read on your opponent and say they're going to be able to deal with this, so I play the long game. But conversely, you have to say, I don't think you have it. Show me. Otherwise, you're dead.
Yeah. I play, in fact, far too conservatively. I just almost never go for it.
Yeah.
And I think that, like, a lot of players play, again, too aggressively and try and just jam too much. And so it's really a balance.
But yeah, you watch Tom Ross, and, like, he will play the chip game. Like, he will deal you one infect for 10 turns, and he'll win a game that way. And he'll just, like, raw dog invigorate with a Noble Hierarch and a Blighted Agent. And just, like, do you have it?
Yeah. So, just, like, it's very important.
Yeah.
Very, very important. So we've got, I think it's really important to reflect a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And really just, like, adjust. And Mike, you had this quote that you wanted to...
Yeah, this is from a book I was reading. It's about improving and stuff, but it's from Confucius. It's, learning without reflection is a waste. Reflection without learning is dangerous.
Yeah. I think that's really important.
Yeah.
You need to both be able to, like, progress and reflect.
And doing one or the other is not beneficial.
You can learn all you want, but if you're not improving, like, if you're not retrospectively changing the things that you're doing incorrectly...
Yeah, you have to apply that learning.
Yeah.
That's what this episode's all about. We want to kind of break down, like, this is something I've been thinking about a long time, as Magic has all these really lofty ideas of how to play the game and get better, and it's hard to make these concrete things about, this is what I can do to get better. And so we see a lot of just grinding. We even call it, like, you know, people who play on PPTQs regularly. It's they're grinders. They're trying to get on the tour.
Yeah, they just, like, they're trying to improve by just playing all the Magic.
By volume of games, yeah.
Yeah.
And we're trying to break down, what are the specific things you can do to improve?
While grinding out a lot of games is good, mm-hmm. I don't know if it's necessarily the most beneficial way of improving.
It's always a mixture of the number of hours you work on something, but also the quality of those hours.
Yeah.
Like, having a one solid hour of practicing anything where you're in the zone is worth way more than 10 hours where you're mindlessly doing it.
Very much so. So then we've got, like, we don't have any more specific topics, but going back, all of these different things have various ceilings.
Mm-hmm.
So your basic math can only get, like, so good.
Yeah.
Well,
it's also, we talk about ceilings, it's also kind of like these points of diminishing returns. You can continue to improve in these areas, but it's not worth it as much. Once you get to a certain point, you're almost better kind of just keeping that nice and polished and then working on improving in other areas.
Yeah. You can learn math to an extent.
Yeah.
You can study the rules to a certain extent, and mm-hmm. then everything past that's just sort of like, it's important to, like, know the rules, but there is only so much to be learned.
Yeah, exactly. Like, there's always going to be some weird interaction that you're not going to be 100% on.
And that's why there are judges that you can call.
Yeah. But it's important to know the fundamental interactions so that when something happens, you know what's going to happen, you know how it's supposed to interact. This is also, like, Legacy is a format where there's not as deep a judge pool for smaller events.
Oh, yeah.
So there's a lot of, and the L1s or L2s that end up judging Legacy events may not necessarily be as familiar with the format and the interactions thereof. So it's really important. Like, I remember in GP New Jersey, I had to explain Chalice of the Void to the judge and what a missed trigger was and had to appeal it, which was kind of frustrating. But if I didn't know that, then I would have just been like...
On the other hand, like, judges of all levels make mistakes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And
this is no way to, like,
yeah,
the detriment of the judge program. It's just that Legacy's got some weird shit in it. And
also,
it's always to your advantage and benefit to know what that is.
Everyone is human and they make mistakes.
Yeah.
Unless you're Data.
That's not a human.
Yeah, I said you're human unless you're Data. All right. Fuck it, never mind. So, judges will make mistakes at some point.
Yeah.
In Grand Prix New Jersey, I saw an extremely prominent, like, I'm not going to name.
We talked about this already.
Yeah, okay, we did.
There was a big judge making a big boo-boo.
Yeah.
It happens.
Yeah. On the matter of, like, knowing the rules, though, there's another thing that I thought of just now, is that it's really important to know the rules interactions for basic cards, because if you call for a judge, and you step away from the table to ask a rules question, your opponent can probably just, like, then try and figure out what card you have, and might gain information from that.
Yeah.
Alternatively, you might just not step far enough away, and your opponent might just be able to hear you.
Yeah.
Like, this happens all the time. Judges really need to step farther away.
Or you as a player can ask to step further away from the table.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah. Like, amount of information that has just been, like, given away by somebody calling a judge.
And asking for an oracle text on this card.
Yeah, yeah. It's just like,
Even when, like, say I'm asking for oracle text of a card my opponent could potentially have, that gives my opponent information about where my head's at and what I'm trying to navigate around.
Absolutely.
Even if they don't have the card.
Yeah.
And they get the benefit of starting to bluff that, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. Then we've got card pool, which is, again, it's just like a body of knowledge. You can learn a bunch of it.
Mm-hmm.
There are going to be things that you don't know, things that you do know. Yeah. It's just sort of like another, it's just a body of knowledge.
Yeah. Basically, what this comes down to is math, the rules, and the card pool, these are all things that can actually be studied independently. And that's just, you know, however much time you decide to dedicate to it, you can improve. Whereas something like evaluation and mental state, I feel like you really need someone else with you, like some form of playtest group or friend, to just kind of bounce ideas off of and talk through. They're not something that... There are certain things you can practice on your own, like in the heat of the moment, but I feel those are the things that are hard to touch on, and it helps to have someone else, you know, guide you.
Yeah, a lot of it is very either intangible or perspective-based.
Yeah.
So really, having other people to discuss things with is very important.
Yeah.
They also just have, like, the highest ceiling, I think, in terms of level of improvement.
Yeah.
Like, I think that these are the areas in which pro players have the rest of us beat.
Yep.
By, like, a huge margin. Like, I've, like, listened to a lot of pro players talk when I've, like, been sitting next to them at events or whatever, and they don't necessarily know the rules or, like, the card pool better than anyone else, but they can apply their, like, their ability to manipulate their own mental state and their ability of evaluation to just crush everyone else.
Yeah. You hear stories all the time of, like, LSV's legendary ability to, like, watch a game, like, that he's just passing by, look at it for 2 seconds, and know exactly what's going on, what's supposed to happen, what the best play is based on one player's hand.
Yeah.
And that's just because he's, like, really good at it.
Oh, yeah. So, just constantly evaluate your own progress and how you can improve, I think.
Yeah, that's the gist of it. There are no shortcuts. It's all, we're trying to make it less of a grind, but...
But it is a grind.
It is a grind. You can do something super efficiently, but you still need to do a lot of it.
Yeah.
And at a, like, this is the, evaluating yourself is a good habit. And that's what we're trying to instill.
Yeah. It's also important to not just think of these things as being magic-specific things.
Nope.
The card pool and the rules are obviously very magic-specific things, but math is not. Your own mental state is really not a magic-specific thing, and I think that's a really important thing to just success in life. And evaluation applies to a lot of other things. The logical reasoning that you gain by being able to play Magic effectively is something that you can apply to other similar games. You can apply it to life in a lot of ways.
Yeah, just being able to defend your position about anything. It's like, why do I think about, like, why do I hold this opinion?
As always, I'm Matt Chow.
And I'm Michael White. We will see you guys next week. Goblins! You may or may not leave that in.
Thanks for listening. I'm Matt Chow.
And I'm Michael White. For comments and feedback, we can be reached at levelup legacy@gmail.com.
You can find us on Twitter @levelup legacy.